course it's episode one, it's Toby.
Oh no.
Is that a link from series one to two?
Oh okay. Dear.
Right. Pressure.
You can swear.
Oh, you could swear last time.
Oh, couldn't you?
This is a revelation.
You can swear all you want in this. Hello and welcome to series two of Tell Them, a podcast hosted by Tamasha in partnership with Transmission Roundhouse.
This podcast is a space where global majority movers and shakers reflect and critique work that lies across our cultural spectrum, unpacking connected contemporary issues and dissecting the affairs rooted in our respective cultures. We will review works of every nature, books, articles, audio work, digital content, film, TV and theatre.
My name is Tue and I'm the digital producer for Tamasha.
And my name is Samia and I am one of the producers at Tamasha.
And you are tuning in to episode one, where we are going to discuss permanent black spaces in the arts. Reach out to me. And you may have already listened to series one, and if not, get on it as soon as you can. It's available to stream on our socials and Transmission Roundhouse platforms. If you are one of our dedicated listeners, you will know that the one and only Toby Chirimetang was our presenter for all five episodes, which fills me with nothing but excitement to have her as our guest presenter for our very first episode of series two. Hi, Toby.
Hello.
Hello. So, Toby is, without a doubt, one of the most talented and, let's face it, iconic producers from South London. Big up. Yeah, you can see, so you can't see what's going on in this room, but there's a lot of big up in gesticulation.
A little bagel, yeah. A little finger.
And I think I'm bursting with joy, as everyone else is in this room, to have her here to hold such an exciting conversation with our equally brilliant guests today. So take the mic, Toby.
Awesome. What's good, people? Welcome back. Welcome to season two of Tell Them. Yeah, sip that water, anyone. Come on. No, it's all right. You've got time. I'm doing a little intro. I'm really excited to be back hosting this conversation for episode one. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
I'm joined by two of my favourite people ever, basically.
Yeah.
Some of my favourite people. Let me not exclude my parents. But some of my favourite people in the arts, but also in life. I'm joined by Amara and Inua, and I could do introductions. I'll do a mini introduction, but okay. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves.
Be sure.
Inua, what can I say about Inua?
Just decide. Just let air hover. Ever. Just decide. That's fine.
He is probably one of my favourite artists in life. I'm very inspired by a lot of your work. I've been inspired by a lot of your work for a long time, and now we're friends.
Thank you.
Yeah, which is cool.
And you just see that it just leaks.
Yeah, then out, it's just like
ungracefully, exactly. Like a swan shitting.
That's Inua Ellums.
Hi, my name is Inua Ellums. I am a swan shitting for life. That's pretty much most of what I think that's actually an apt description of what I do. Maybe I'm shit shitting swans, because I like to think what I create is beautiful and is a vision of the world that exceeds my capabilities and my presentation. I'm shit shitting swans. My name is, I'm a writer. And primarily I'm a poet. Well, actually, maybe things have shifted. I don't know. I begin from the space where poetry has the potential to exist, but what is produced kind of leaks out into various shapes and forms. I write theater, essays, film, and I also curate a whole bunch of events. That's enough.
I feel like that introduction was like the perfect analogy for our friendship. This is just a standard conversation with you. It just like starts from a place of like frivolousness and then goes into like some deep shit and then it's like, whoa. And then it will be like, all right, anyway. So yeah, love that. And Amara again is someone that I met quite a few years ago and was already like tearing down walls and like badding people up in the industry and just basically just like paving the way for, I think, a very specific way of thinking around creative expression and the arts and kind of what it means to exist in these different spaces, but also the places that we make work from. She's just my fave.
Mm-hmm.
And she does everything, does it all.
Kind of like you then.
Amara, over to you.
Hi everyone, my name's Amara Spence. If you can't tell, I'm from Birmingham, like big up the Birmingham Massive. I don't know, I feel like I come to this conversation with the most gratitude because both of you are people that I admire and have admired for a really long time. And I also come to this conversation as an artist who is interested in like how we give things form. And that could be for me, like I work a lot in performance, music, theatre, narrative, but also spatial practice and building and making spaces. And I can't wait to get into all of that with you guys.
I guess kind of like having this conversation with the two of you for me is really exciting because it feels like you both do very interesting work in terms of how you use space and form within particular spaces. That for me, it's kind of like an FU to like, I guess like the architecture of these spaces. Mm-hmm. Like you kind of come into a space and you're just like, cool, this isn't, you know, I don't know, a traditional library. This is whatever I want it to be. It's your playground. And then you just do whatever you want. And you kind of like completely transform the spaces in your own ways, which I really love and I really appreciate. 1,000 years ago, I wrote an article about permanent black spaces. I think I was just going through a whole thing about permanence and was like, why is everything in life so temporary? And it really jarred me, especially when it came to space. And that was born out of like raving spaces and other, you know, there are events like once a month and there's like a temporality around it. And it got on my nerves. And I was like, what would it actually look like to have a space that was there all the time? And we knew that it was there, and maybe not even a space, but multiple spaces, you know. And lots has happened since I wrote that article. But I guess like something that I wanted to start talking to the two of you about was just about like your relationship with space, because I feel like, you know, Amara, with you, and I guess like you draw, it feels like you draw a lot from your grandparents, but also just this like spiritual, like ancestral kind of space. And Inua, like with your work, you moved around a lot, do you know what I mean? Like in terms of your relationship to movement and like being placed somewhere. So I really want to just start with talking about your relationship to space and permanence / temporality. Who wants to go first?
Big words. Amara, please.
I love how you did that. You think you slick, huh? I'll warm you up. I guess, thank you so much for that question as well, Toby. And I love speaking specifically about Black space with you. And I've had so many conversations with you over time where we're like, I feel like we're growing in our philosophy as we're in communion. So I'm like, I draw a lot on my grandparents, but and this generation, right, the sort of tail end of the Windrush generation. When my grandparents came here, like many of our elders and our peers came here, and they were like, the only way we're going to survive is collectively. Like, I have to share my yard with you. I have to share these responsibilities, these duties with you. And there was this innate collectivism that I was like, all right, this is dope. Let's not romanticize that, though. Let's not romanticize, like, you know, our ancestors before us, they had it all patterned. They did not, Chuck. Like, they really did not. So how do we both respect the gaps while also acknowledging this idea of futurity? You know, how do we build both forward and past? And I guess I come to this as someone who, I mean, I've lived in Birmingham my whole life. And I've moved around a lot in Birmingham my whole life. I really have an ever-changing sense of like place and what it means to be rooted. You know, there feels like this this disconnect both between like the practice of making space as, you know, a young millennial, but also I had such a challenge with infrastructure in Birmingham as an artist, but also as a resident, like that there were so few art spaces in the city where I could be myself in any which way I feel to be myself, because we're coming to this as traumatized people, we're coming to this as hurt people, as people who have been hurt by systems around us, infrastructures around us. So we need new precedents to build from. So what I've been doing is Birmingham is saying, and what are the precedents that we want to build in the spirit of? We took on a house in 2020, so just before lockdown came and kicked our asses. We took some keys on for a house and we reimagined it and turned it into a site of imagination. And we said, it's not enough to think about space in a way that like, how do we make artwork happen here? What's the spirit that we want it to inhabit? And we said, I want the spirit of this place to feel for you how my granddad's house feels for me. And we've been like practicing what that looks like. And I just feel like I'm in this, like my relationship with time and space feels like one of a practice in itself. And I'm excited to be in a place where I feel like those are my artistic tools. Time and space are my medium. Mm-hmm. Anyway, what you saying?
I remember reading somewhere that when black artists, African artists, maybe African specifically, make work, we think a lot about time and space, and it becomes one of the creative tools, and we don't adhere to it in the way some people from other cultures do. Mm-hmm. Like we fuck around with time. We write a play which is set on one day but spread over 6 countries. Like mm-hmm. My first play all happened within the imagination of sitting in a hospital wondering about conversations with my father. My second play was set in the middle of a forest, but the person who's telling the story is telling the story to the ancestors who strike him with lightning. Then the entire second half happens between him being struck by lightning and him being resurrected by his own twin brother. So I think there were parts of us constantly grappling with time and space. And I think you're absolutely right. But I think mine comes from the acceptance of temporality, of liminality, of thinking, I'm here for only a short period of time. What can I do? How can I fuck it up? How can I bend it to my will without leaving any permanent footprints or seeds or marks of myself on this space? I think it's how the Midnight Run functions. We walk through a city for a duration of time. We build things with people that last for maybe half an hour, maybe an hour. We try not to leave too many marks in the city and go. A lot of that comes from being an immigrant and thinking if I stay here too hard, they're going to come and deport us. So you have to keep moving, but you need to make as much time and as much memory and as much communion as you can whilst being hyper aware of outward threats and pressures, each constantly encroaching, coming on you. And same thing with the rap party, which is all about using music to bend time. There's this saying about how music is how we decorate time, but visual art is how we decorate space, and trying to use lyrics and lyricism to do that. And, you know, there are times when I'm completely buried in a poem and I'm reading it, and I think 3 hours have passed, and then it's just a couple of 3 minutes because you're just sinking deeper and deeper, like Inception, where you keep on reading, you know, you're falling deeper and deeper into the memory. Yeah. And, you know, so it's really poignant and pivotal to my work, really thinking, but it's never really conscious. It just sort of unfolds like that each time. I was being interviewed in somewhere in Shoreditch, and they asked us about legacy. What would you like your legacy to be on Earth?
I really don't like that question.
I know. It's so gross, right?
I'm just like, I'm just trying to be here and enjoy myself with my peoples and just do what we can. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, this feeling of like, which I think also sometimes happens, even when it comes to making work, is sort of like, oh, how do you think this is going to like impact the entire black community? And it's just like, bro, like, I made a thing and I thought it was cool, and other people happen to think it's cool, and that's great. We enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And that's enough.
Full
do you know
stuff,
what I mean? Yeah. As opposed to like, cool, but like, how is this going to inspire future generations to make work, or how is it going to inspire them to like step into that space? And it's like, if that happens, that's cool. Mm-hmm. But this idea of like every little thing that you do, or every little thing that you make, everywhere that you step, has to have this like greater impact beyond the thing that you've just done like a second ago.
There's this, I love this story, I keep on telling it, where Yo-Yo Ma was traveling through Botswana trying to record goat herdsmen singing into the savannah. And he sees this goldheart singing in the distance, and Yo-Yo Ma runs up to him with his dictaphone or whatever and says, okay, sing the same song. And the goldheart sings a completely different song. And Yo-Yo Ma is baffled. It's like, bro, can you sing the other one? Because Dashi was banging. And the goldheart is like, well, the first time I sang, there was antelope in the distance and the cloud covered, you know, the sun. And last time I sang, the antelope had gone and the cloud had gone. So the song had to be different. So for him, music responds to time. It isn't fixed, you know. And this idea of permanence is all to do with trying to capture music so you can reproduce it on vinyl and then sell it again. Where the goldman was like, that's not why I sing. I sing because I'm here, because I'm alive, because I'm free. And that's what I'm trying to mark in this moment.
I feel like this grapple that I have with temporality and permanence is because I think kind of like what you've both been saying, like I think there was a point where temporality was expected, just generally, like it was something that I was very comfortable with and I accepted, and it was like, oh, okay, this thing no longer exists. Oh, I'm walking down Brixton. Oh, the shop isn't here anymore. Yeah, of course it's not. Do you know what I mean? Like, and you just kind of like, I found myself like moving through the city and moving through life, just kind of being like,
but I think okay, this thing doesn't happen. There's a balance between you willing to let something go and something being stolen from you.
Yeah.
And that's the tension. There's temporality and then there's theft. And they are two different things, yeah.
It's choice, isn't it? It's always choice, and that, you know, the power and the access to make the choices. And choices are one thing, but what are the options that I even have to choose from? You know, in Birmingham, we like look to our peers in London and say, oh, you know, if they get a big fat no from one space, they can go and find another one. In Birmingham, we're like, yo, if they say no, we've got nowhere else to go. You know, we have to leave our places. And how many options do we even have to choose from in the first place? Particularly as people who are trying to make work for our own reasons and motivations, and it's not the impact piece, or it's not the legacy piece, it's about present. And I can't think of any challenge of our time which doesn't have some connection to land. And by default, that has connections to empire, colonialism, and all of those things. But I can't think of how land does not butt up against like the challenges that we're all trying to navigate, no matter where we are in the world.
There were like two spaces that I want to talk about. And I say, when I say spaces, I mean that in like the most abstract way, considering like this conversation. And it can, I guess, like spun off to different things, but I really want to talk about Yard, and I really want to talk about Rap Party. I mean, with Yard, the conversation about Yard was like, it felt like it existed before its like physical form. Do you know what I mean? Like, I remember chatting with you about this, the possibility of the space, or just like the imagining of the space, and then like finally stepping in into it and being like, oh shit, that was a conversation on a bench one time that is now like a physical thing. Or like the first like rap party that I went to, and in my head just being like, oh okay, like at the time I was so tired of going to open mics, I can't lie, and I was like, is this going to be very open mic-y where I gotta like listen to like some poetry that may or may not be very good, and then like hear a Spotify playlist, you know, like in between sets, like is that gonna be the vibe? And I just felt like the curation of it, like I was so like sucked into the space that for me felt like the first ever rave that I went to that was kind of illegal and probably shouldn't have happened, but did, and was probably like one of the best times of my life. And I think there's something about the way that you both curate these spaces in like both like the physical, but also just in like the feeling, like the spiritual of it as well. I really want to talk about that kind of initial like thought or process of like, oh, this is why this is necessary for me, but then also maybe for others, and this is why I decided to do it in this way.
Should I go first, or do you want to?
I was gonna say, you're gonna throw it to Amara again.
This one.
That's how you
okay
go.
So I had a really great basketball coach when I lived in Dublin in Ireland, and it was also my poetry teacher. And half of the basketball team were in my English class. So we used to sit down dissecting Shakespeare and John Keats and all of those, and, you know, Seamus Heaney, and having these really intense conversations about poetry, because our English teacher slash poetry teacher slash basketball coach demanded that we do so. And then we go home afterwards, and because they were all basketball nerds, they were all listening to hip-hop. So we'd be listening to lyricism, listening to rappers, listening to these narratives and thinking, oh yeah, I swear John Keats said that line that Eminem said. Well, I mean, they're saying the same thing. Oh, wow. Then just blowing our own minds, thinking that these guys were speaking to each other across time and space and generation and languages. And that's probably when I began to think that these two worlds, these two lyricism, these two ways of approaching the attempt to make the impermanent permanent with words, we're sort of in conversation with each other. Mm-hmm. Then years later, I'm in London, I'm beginning to work in the poetry world, but in the page world, and I'm hearing, I'm going to these extremely white spaces where the poets looking down on performance poets. And I'm thinking, you guys don't know what they're talking about. And they don't know what you guys are just arguing. And I got tired of those conversations because I was a fan of both worlds. So I thought, I'm just going to create a space where poets who acknowledge both things exist, who are fans of both things, will share work that speak to each other. And I was speaking to a friend of mine, Joshua Idahem, and he said, Inwell, that's a shit idea. No one's going to give you money to like pay poets to read Josh. one point, bro. 10 of them? That's a grand, bro. No one is going to do that. I said, whatever, man, I'm going to do it myself. So I reached out to the Albany and they said, okay, fine, try it. And it was incredible. It was just, it was everything that I thought it would be and more, because a lot of those poets hadn't been in rooms together, maybe in two or threes, but not 10. Mm. So it felt like a little carnival in this cafe, and it was amazing. So ever since then, I thought, I'm going to try and do this as much as I can. Mm. And the more, quote unquote, popular I became, the more known my name was, I thought, how could I use this to make space for other people who share this love for hip hop and for lyricism as I am? How can I bring them into the fold? And I just haven't looked back ever since.
It feels like hip hop is at like the center of this conversation right now between like the three of us in this little triangle, because it feels like it's somehow been at, I guess, like the core or the genesis of either a lot of our thinking or process or just like the making of it. Do you know what I mean? And to see these play out in real time and kind of like manifest in different ways, it kind of, I don't know, to me it makes me feel like a child again, just like discovering something for the first time. Mm. And then being like, oh shit, I could do this like this. Like, this is a thing that we can just do. And like, Amara, I remember when you announced Yard and I was like, of course this is called Yard. Like, anyone else would have been like, little artistic hotel. And I was like, no, this is Yard. That's it. Do you know what I mean? And it's just like, you immediately feel something. Mm. Like, it immediately places you in the space, even not physically, but like emotionally, spiritually. I was just like, okay, yeah, this is my space. Mm. Before, and that was like a good year or whatever before I actually like stepped my foot in, you know? And yeah, I feel like there's so much that you could talk about with Yard, Amara, and I guess like your, how this like fully encompasses, I guess, like the spirit, like the art of it as well.
I guess I wanted to pick up on the real strength about hip hop, because for me, I've always had this understanding that hip hop is a critique of its environment. Like, hip hop in itself, the genesis of hip hop was like resistance against the built environment that necessitated its birth. It's a critique of the projects, you know, it's a critique of the urban planning decisions that led to the creation of these abandoned and neglected neighborhoods, mm-hmm. Black and POC neighborhoods. Mm. So if we think about that, like, I feel like there has always been a relationship between hip hop and spatial practice that I have always been fascinated in. And I must say that I started to, I guess, develop a vocabulary about spatial politics through John Singleton films. Like, I would watch Friday and be like, oh shit, like South Central Los Angeles, what is happening here spatially? And I will never forget watching Lawrence Fishburne, aka Furious Styles, stand on top of the hill in Boys in the Hood, mm-hmm. talking about gentrification. And I was like, oh, okay. And he was giving this vocabulary to these things sort of playing out, you know, across the global north, mm-hmm. in a way that I started to understand and develop my own voice in relationship to what was happening in the UK. And also reinforced by being a child of the grime era, of listening to, you know, Dizzy in 2002, my belief, my politics, my philosophy, they were the first things that started to help me shape, like, what does this mean in my context? And then I guess the thing about, like, how is that forming into thing? My thing is, everything to me is a practice. In order to shift from wherever we are or wherever we have been into these futures that we all say that we want or believe in or we want to orient towards, the only way to really do that is a practice, which is why I think the role of artists in revolution is so irresistible, in the words of Tony Cade Bambara. It is the idea of artists, we are used to giving form to things. We can give narrative, we give context to ideas, material stories, we give another level. What does it mean if we mm-hmm. shift that orientation, not just to like the form of a thing, but also to liberation? Like, what does the role of artists in shaping what liberation looks like, what does that lend itself to? So for me, space was the first place where I really got to experiment with that. But it was directly mm-hmm. from feeling frustrated as an artist who was couch surfing across South London, trying to like find my way through as I'm on tour, or as I was like doing these residencies, being underpaid or not paid on time, of like, you know, all the things that we have to navigate as independent artists, as freelance artists. I'm staying on my friends' couches and I'm daydreaming about like, yo, if I was actually gonna stay mm-hmm. somewhere in a place that served my needs right now, what would that look like? And I started to dream of this place that, I think about Birmingham and I think about the millions of pounds that the city of Birmingham's cultural sector spends on hospitality alone by way of cultural institutions hosting artists. And I see that those millions of pounds goes to the private landowners, the developers, the hoteliers, and that goes to their shareholders. And it's millions of pounds that I then watch the sector say, oh, we have no money, we're poor, our balance sheet, you know, all of this stuff. And I'm watching this real extractive, like the continuation of that extraction piece. And I said, oh, what if the space that I'm dreaming about looks like a hotel? Like, what would that do? How might we be able to divert some of that millions that would otherwise go to developers into community infrastructure that looked something like a hotel? How might we then be able to design spaces within that hotel where artists could be however they want to be? If it's you want to make work, call the spaces to make work. If you want to share it, the spaces to share it. So calling the prototype yard was like, this is our politics, this is our philosophy. If you know, you know. If you don't know, you're about to get to know. And if you know, and like, how do we create that invitation that says community infrastructure, because we come to this as traumatized people, because we come to this as people who have been harmed or have been confronted by the isms and schisms of the system, of the paradigm that we live in, we've got so much that we need to tend to. And one space alone can't do that. Like, one space cannot be the antidote for all of the things that we have to endure, but it can start to mobilize people together. And that's where I'm kind of like, let's go, let's go.
There's so much about being led by the spirit. So that I've been having to write a lot about space for this never ending book that just won't get out of my life. But I've been trying not to write about it from a space of like lack, which I think is something that you both do as well. Like, it's not necessarily about like, we don't have this or this doesn't exist or whatever, even though obviously those are valuable things to know and to understand. But it seems to become the centre of the conversation, which then evolves into the diversity inclusion industrial complex that we're living in right now, with everyone's post-it notes and all them things there. But it's like, but actually, I've been trying to not think about it from a space of lack, but I guess like being more guided by the spirit of sitting in certain spaces. And I guess like how these architectures or how these spaces become secondary characters to the thing that I'm trying to experience. And so through that, I ended up writing a lot about like laughter and sweat. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I ended up in the space of writing very in-depthly about bodies and just like the way that we move and like respond to things. But I feel like everyone knows that feeling of being in a space and someone says something or someone does something and there's this like outburst of laughter, mm-hmm. and the way that it just like ruffles across a room,
mm-hmm.
and that feeling, like the thing that it does to the spirit, or you know, someone's, it reminds me of like when I went to see Nine Night and there were certain jokes in there that Sally and Tim did not understand,
mm-hmm.
and it was just like the scatter of laughter across the space that kind of created this little bubble that I could sit in that was sort of like, oh, that particular thing was ours. Like we had a level of ownership over that moment, mm-hmm. or over that movement, because there was a collective language that we all understood, even if not everyone around me understood it. And there's something really beautiful about how that kind of like connects me to certain people. And so I started to think just a lot about, I guess, how often like when we're making stuff, when we're doing stuff, we're guided by our spirits, and not in a way that has to be like super like deep and like
mm-hmm.
ancestral, but actually just as an integral part of our practice that's just about the feeling thing. Yeah. I guess also in a space that is very insistent on like the outcome, yeah. what is the thing that you're making, and how is that gonna sell,
my god,
and how do you talk to people about that work, and how do you make, how does it win an Olivier, and how does it do this and how does it do that, and then the spirit just is decimated. So as anyone
getting shifted, because man, there were a couple of Royal Rumbles when we were working on Three Sisters at the National Theatre, because, and you know, fortunately I was able to get away with some things. Because there were some jokes, some lines written that I knew worked on multiple levels. They were like, okay, Tim and Sally would not get it. Africans would get it. West Africans would get it on another level. Nigerians would get it on another level.
Mm.
Igbo people would get it on another level.
Mm.
And there were times where I could hear, especially in the little, I could hear who was in the audience. Yeah. And the actors really got to key into that, and then they just knew who they were performing to and how far to push things, and how far not to push things, because they knew they wouldn't get anything in return. And it's one of the most exhilarating moments of writing a play, is when you realize it's like what do you call the guys who lead orchestras? Conductor.
Yes.
It's like conductor being aware.
So different.
of the full capabilities of music, and he's just there with a stick, and he knows if he does this, the trombones are gonna, you know, bang extra hard, and it's just knowing that the actors were feeling that on stage. It was, it's the most incredible moment sometimes, sitting in an audience. And even when I was performing An Evening with an Immigrant, which is the show I have about my immigration history, there were some lines in poems that I knew if you grew up in the 80s, you would get this cultural reference. And with that, I could sense who was in the audience, they know how far to push things. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, the relationships you build there in these liminal moments. And they're just really, really exciting. And then you begin to have these conversations with the script editors, with the building, saying, you can't write that, you can't say that, because, you know, it's going to alienate this amount of people. Right. These people may be offended. And I keep on trying to say, what is the story you're telling? Who is this authentic? Who's this for? And what is lost in sacrificing these gems that are culturally specific?
Mm.
And even in Barbershop Chronicles, oh my God, there was one conversation where I just refused to have it. I said, no, I'm not cutting this line. And I left. And fortunately, the director was on my side. So he said, yeah, we're not.
What was the line?
It was when Emmanuel, who is the guy who runs the barbershop, was discussing the slave trade and the use of the N-word.
Right. Yeah.
And he said that when we use the word, we're reclaiming some of what was lost. And he compared that to the devastation that 30 million Africans minimum were killed. but in the Holocaust there were six, and it was to do with reclamation of what is allowed certain people. And it wasn't talking down the Holocaust or anything. It was just saying these are just factual numbers here.
Mm-hmm.
And that I refused to remove the line, and because they thought we might offend some people, but nothing ever came of it at all. Mm-hmm. And the audience got it, because audiences tend to be far more intelligent than the people who run the buildings and just stories unfold. and the other, no one ever battered an eyelid. No one.
Because then now we're in a sort of tussle in between the thing that is like leading our spirit and then like having to like step into the space of, you know, having certain conversations and it becoming like very commercial all of a sudden.
Mm.
Whereas I guess sometimes we have this idea of, this is the thing that I want to make, or this is the thing that I want to do, even just as artists. And then, you know, what's the process that you do that within the theatre industry specifically, or any kind of creative arts? You go to the people that have the money and you're like, I want to make this. And they're like, okay, I like this and I like this and I like this. I don't know about this.
Mm.
Mainly because I don't understand it.
Yeah.
Not because of anything else. And then all of a sudden you're kind of tussling between the context of being an artist in this industry, or just in this world, in the state that it's in right now, but also what your spirit is leading you towards doing or wanting to do, and who you feel that's going to serve. And like, how do you navigate that as artists? I think that's why I'm kind of happy I'm not an artist and I don't have to have that. So, I mean, I have it in other ways, but not in the sense where it's like I'm making a thing and now I'm having to justify almost certain aspects of this thing, or I'm having to figure out what are the things that I'm willing to sacrifice, what are the things that I'm willing to hold on to, because now we're going into a context of business, which ultimately is operating from a capitalistic point of view and not from a spirit-led point of view of what it's gonna, of how it's gonna serve communities and people.
Yeah.
How are you still an artist, basically?
you know what it is, yeah. I used to really, really struggle with this, right? And I used to struggle with it because I was like, yo, if we don't rare to tear, then we don't eat.
Mm.
Or we don't, you know, like, we don't even get the basics. And the amount of times that I've entered into relationships or dynamics and where, like, yo, I did everything I was supposed to do anyway and it still didn't, you know. I was still paid shit. I was still broken and tired. They still call me somebody else's name. You know, like, that thing very quickly taught me, like, you need to, one, practice radical honesty with yourself first about what it is you actually want to do and why, because that will in itself inform like who you need to be doing that with. I do not enter into relationships for the sake of doing the work. If we wanted to have a hotel for a hotel's sake, we would have took a developer's 10-year lease. It would have taken us 3 years to organize our finance, organize ourselves in order to have a thing running in the way we want, which means we would have had a building for about 7 years. Two of them would have been taken. Basically, we get down to like 5 years of doing the things that it took this lease. That to me, it might be able to do some cool stuff in the here and now, but that's not transformative. When I say like practice radical honesty with myself, that in itself will tell me, like, my radical honesty will guide me in terms of what are the relationships that's going to serve that. And I think in doing that, it's helped me create like my negotiables and my non-negotiables. There are things that I'm absolutely not prepared to compromise. And I think that so many times we're not really honest about the change that we want. So like, I'll say, yeah, I'm an artist. Like, I really want to change things. Like, I want my community to rare-tear-tear. And our practice is completely counterintuitive to the thing that we said that we were orienting towards, it makes sense to do that in the paradigm that we live in, but I need us to be really honest about like where we are in this horizon of change, you know. And I think the other thing about horizons of change is it needs lots of people within the current system to be holding a space. It needs people who are visioning something else. It needs the builders, it needs the stabilizers, and it also needs people to help when a thing needs to die. Somebody to help it die well. Do you know what I mean? When things need to end, let it end in the most generative way possible. And that could be a company, a project, a relationship, anything. But for me, the thing that I always come back to is that radical honesty with myself. What is it I'm trying to actually do?
So many interesting things you said. I remember when I first watched Hamilton, I've watched it quite a few times on Disney Plus. One of my favorite songs is when George Washington...
That's what you were doing during lockdown.
Yes. Yes. Listen, crying, weeping into my sofa. When George Washington sings that song, Teach Them How to Say Goodbye, he's one of his songs, he sings with Hamilton. It's like, I'm done. I don't want to be here anymore. I'm done. And just the concept of letting go gracefully, of retreating, is something I don't think we're allowed to experience, because we have to hold on to so much, because, you know, it was just the first time I'd seen it illustrated so beautifully in a musical. And I always remember that. How do you let go gracefully? How do you see things out?
Well, I also feel like that comes from like a, I don't know about you lot's families yet, but my families are hoarders. And I really feel like that is like a movement thing.
Completely.
Again, like when we're coming
immigrant
back
trauma
to
completely
temporality and permanence, like mom was like, we never know when we might need, and she's like, we definitely don't need this, and noticing that in her. But then also when I moved house, the way I'm hoarding shit to this day that I know, but in my head I'm just like, one
to
day,
this day
you know, I'm just like, one day I might need this thing. Like, I can't just,
I've had to enforce a one in one out policy for clothes and footwear. The only time I break it is my tote bag collection. I have way too many. That's it. But generally, one in, one out.
When we kind of talk about, you know, like letting things go, like, I don't know, there's something in my spirit that is just like, but is this going to come back to me in another way? So if we're talking about, you know, like letting something go in the most like generative way possible. Yeah.
But even just going back to what you were saying about if something is successful or not, and what it means when you, we have to have these conversations about what is commercially successful. I just never think about it. There were times when we were cast.
Do you feel like you had to get to that? Get to a certain point to do that?
I've never created anything expecting it to be commercially successful. I've always thought, I just need to create what makes me feel good. And then I've been lucky. This is the last book that came out. One of the big publishers wanted to publish the book, but I discovered that one of the editors had been accused of sexual harassment, and the publishing house just chose to stick by him. And he wanted to publish my book. They were throwing numbers at me. And I called my agents. I was like, no, I'm not taking this. She said, it's very prestigious. This could make your career. I was like, no, but every time I talk about this book, which discussed hypermasculinity and blah, blah, exactly. I'm going to, like, you know.
Yeah.
And I spoke to a few other poets and I said, yeah, you know, every time his name is going to be there. So, yeah, I said, okay, I can't do this. I just can't. And, you know, argue, definitely if I'd published with them, it'd have been on blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But I refuse to. And I love this book. And every time people find it from this small independent publisher pen in the margin, I'm like, yeah, my soul sits well with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So during lockdown, we did like a digital rap party. Mm-hmm. Who was it for?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God.
Anyway, it was for like a company, and they had very specific rules around the things that poets could and could not do. And one of them was no swearing. So Inua decided to read from his book of farts. And it was literally just like, and this poem is called Fuck Tupac, and fuckity fuck. And you were the last poet to go up, and I was literally just sitting there like, this guy trying to kill me. And then he was like, all right, thanks, bye. And I was like, jeez.
Yeah. They called me up for a conversation afterwards. Yeah.
Literally, the nine poets before you were like, I'm not going to swear, not even a little bit. My friend was like, I have this book of fucks, and I'm going to read one of the many fuck poems in this fuck book. So that was my little anecdote about Inua and just how he doesn't listen to people and how that sometimes works in his favour.
Sometimes.
Inua, Amara, thank you. I've really loved this conversation.
Thank you so much. Me too.
Thank you, me too.
Do it again sometime.
I know.
We have to do this in person.
Wow. Thank you so much to all three of you for such a great first episode. I've really enjoyed the love and joy that you guys have for each other and the love that you bring into spaces and work that you do. So just keep being you. So just for our listeners, the article written by Toby that gave birth to this conversation is called Congregation as an Act of Joy, Why I Believe Permanent Black Theatre Spaces Are a Necessity. And you can find that on her website. So it does pain me to end any good conversation, but alas, we do have more in store for you. And if you're bursting with the need to wanting more, please do tune into next week's episode where May Mack joins us to bring into conversation what is it to be queer and Asian in Britain, with some really exciting guests joining her. Follow us on our socials for announcements and check out our website, tamasha.org.uk, and see if there's anything else that you might enjoy. Also, if you liked what you heard, then do go on our Twitter page and hashtag tell them, spelled as TELLDEM, and tell us your thoughts. Thank you so much again to our guests, and what a joy to have you all in the same room and kind of digital in the room. still has an amazing presence though. So thank you, and that is it. Reach out to me. Amara, we forgot to ask, did you click record? Oh, yay! Oh my gosh, love you! I was like, no.